The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The FA Cup fifth round, Rochdale scare Spurs, Wednesday hold Swansea, and the VAR lines go all squiggly at Huddersfield. West Brom are out just a few days after four of their players were out. We'll try and keep a straight face while discussing taxi gates. We'll round up everything from Spain with Sid and get the rest of Europe, including a last-minute win for everyone's favourite Italian underdog, Benevento. All that feedback corner, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel today. Priya Ramesh, how are you?
Very good, thanks. How are you, Matt?
Yeah, I'm wonderful, thanks. Barney Ronay, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Just fresh from a mini-break in Norfolk.
Yeah, I've never felt better.
Barry, have you ever felt better?
Yes, I have. I think I've come down with the lurgy.
Is this because you stopped smoking? Is this like the sort of train spotting?
Possibly. I doubt it. Okay. But I think it's just an unfortunate coincidence. But yeah, I do feel a bit shivery. I don't think it's withdrawal, though. Barry, possibly because my giving up smoking hasn't quite gone according to plan.
Oh, Barry.
Since last we spoke.
Oh. You're not going to take up vaping, are you? It's a horrible habit.
You could try lollipops. Johan Cruyff used to suck on lollipops on the sideline when he gave up smoking at Barcelona.
Tell me again what killed him.
You could be the face of Chupa Chups, Barry.
I'd happily be the face of Chupa Chups.
Okay, that's something to
I'm just imagining Barry's face on Chupa Chups.
Well, that'd be a one.
It's not such a stretch, is it?
It would make me buy them, frankly. Okay. Shall we start at Rochdale then? Rochdale 2, Spurs 2. Barney, there is something glorious about Spurs' last two results being 2-2 draws, one against the Champions League finalists and one against the bottom side in League One, isn't there?
Yeah, it's great. And it was a great occasion. And I'm very glad they're having a replay at Wembley. I mean, people will sort of agonise over whether we can still call these results upsets because of the lack of intensity in top teams, the way they play. And we do see more and more of these kind of results. But as anyone who supports a low league side will tell you, who cares? It's a great result and it's fantastic for them and really good for the town and everything. And I hope they go to Wembley and win.
And they won't, yes, Rochdale fans won't be going, well, it was a weakened Spurs team, so frankly, we didn't care. They definitely cared. And just, there were just so many nice, I mean, it's a surprise that they're bottom of League One.
Yeah, I can't claim to have seen much of Rochdale this season, but
call yourself a football journalist.
Indeed. But that must have been an uncharacteristically good performance from them, because if they even played at, you know, 70% of that level, usually, there's no way on God's green earth they should be anywhere near the bottom of the table. But as it is, they're adrift. I think 11 points from safety, but they've got a lot of games in hand, so all is not lost. But hopefully they can take confidence from that. But yeah, it does seem rather odd. Like, their midfield yesterday was sensational. They took the game to Spurs. There was no fluke about this result.
It's an interesting question, though, isn't it? Because the difference between really top athletes and athletes a few tiers down is simply being able to play at that all the time, isn't it? I mean, if you actually put these people next to each other physically, there's not a huge difference between them. It's just the ability to constantly play at a really high level that makes these people superstars. And that's the magic of the cup.
Yeah, it is that kind of occasion of the cup. And psychologically, I think that does have an effect on the players, in as much as this game is going to be televised, it's going to come under the microscope of many people that, you know, haven't heard of them before. As Barney said, I mean, the cliche of the magic of the cup is that you have a result like that, that, you know, if you play that game 9 times out of 10, you'll end up with a Spurs win. But it is that one time you end up with, which was a fair result in a draw, and they get to have a great day at Wembley.
Priya, I don't always want to just go back to the fact that you're younger than all of us, because mainly I'm jealous about it. But for us, our generation, the FA Cup was a huge thing. You represent younger people. Do you care about it?
Well, I mean, I care about it because it's just more football and you get to hear these stories. I mean, there was Bradford, was it, a few years ago? Was that the League Cup?
Oh, that was the FA Cup when they won at Chelsea.
And when Wigan won, it is kind of paves way for those kind of upsets. And I am a stickler for a good story, and it's just always nice to see the underdog win, especially in this era where the Premier League is basically the top six versus everyone else. It's nice to break out of the entire Premier League bubble and, you know, watch teams that are lower down in the league but still can put up an impressive performance like Rochdale did.
Actually, I think Bradford did the League Cup as well, didn't they? They did very well in the FA Cup and they did very well in the League
Cup. They got to the final, didn't they?
Yes.
But it's weird, isn't it, the FA Cup? It's one of those things where people say there's a problem with the FA Cup, but it all comes down to how much you care about it. If you care about it, there's no problem. If people caring about things seems to be the only problem here, which I suppose it's a consumer product, so that's absolutely central to football now. But if you actually care about it, there's no problem with the FA Cup at all. It's great fun, and you see these brilliant things happening.
Yeah, and actually, look, I'm a Cambridge fan. I didn't care about Rochdale's lovely journey as much as I would if it was us, but I did when we played Manchester United. So you're right. Dele Alli, Josh writes, do you think Dele Alli has just given up on even trying to pretend anymore? I thought it was a penalty. Does everyone think it was a penalty?
I think that statement's very interesting because he said, has Dele Alli stopped pretending? But surely he's trying to pretend. So has he stopped trying to pretend to pretend?
Yeah, pretending he's not pretending.
Yeah.
I find the whole diving thing, it's the most boring, isn't nearly as boring as referees, but I mean, it's one of those things we should just not talk. I mean, talk about caring about things. We should just stop talking about it. It's so boring. I mean, how many games are genuinely affected by someone actually cheating? Really not very many. How many injustices are there? I mean, it's become a kind of bit of a red flag, hasn't it? It's become a kind of emotional issue that people cling to, the idea that something has been tainted, that a once noble sport has been corrupted. And people like those kind of stories. But I don't think people dive any more than they used to. I think probably we stare at football in slow motion a lot more than we used to. I think a lot of things that you see on television don't make sense. If you go and watch a game in the flesh, you'll realise that it's absolute chaos. And often you can hear contact and you can't see it. I think people have just wound themselves up into a knot about it. And it's one of those things. It's like when people start yelling you on Twitter about Brexit. You can just step away. Step away from the people talking about dive. Just mute them and it will go away.
Barry?
Yeah, I'd be largely in agreement with that. The one thing I'd say is that any manager who has players in his team who regularly take a tumble should not have the right to complain about refereeing decisions that go against their team. You know, they should forfeit that right, but that's not going to happen either.
But interestingly, Mauricio Pochettino is a great case, isn't he? Because he is the guy who allegedly tripped Michael Owen. Obviously, he didn't. Michael Owen cleverly won a penalty at the World Cup, which was a massive result at the time. And he has never complained about that, doesn't complain about it, says he thinks players, you know, seeking a little bit of contact is part of the game, as is the kind of, if Wilson was here, he'd probably bang on about the Argentinian way. And so he's a good example of that.
Priya, do you agree with Barney?
Well, I mean, I kind of see the value in the different schools of thought between how a South American view on it, as Pochettino mentioned himself, is kind of cheating is kind of considered an art form. Well, not cheating as such, but let's just say deception of your opponent is considered an art form. And it just kind of comes down to that and different perceptions of what that act is supposed to represent. And, you know, for someone like Pochettino, it's just a player trying to do something to fool the opponents into gaining an advantage for his team. But, you know, to some others, it may be considered a way that brings down the level of the game, or a way that he's trying to circumvent the proceedings. And it's just, I mean, as Barney said, I feel it is a byproduct of this era where we're really focusing on the minute details and like moments and games, as opposed to how that may affect like the actual game itself.
Bardi asks, is Llorente the most pointless footballer in the Premier League? I feel for him because he was so good at Swansea, had a lovely touch, was great in the air, scored a lot of goals, and now just looks just sort of a bit sad and lonely. And you knew when Harry Kane was coming on, he was just like, oh God, I've not managed to do it again.
Yeah, it is odd how players hit just total slumps in form, you know, and it obviously is more apparent with strikers who are failing to score goals and missing good chances. And, you know, it's not like he's a kid who's lost his way, or you never know what's going on behind the scenes in these guys' personal lives or whatever, but the more he plays, and he doesn't get too many opportunities, just the worse it gets. And it's difficult to see him having any sort of future at Spurs.
But I have a feeling Llorente has his more medals than any other Spurs player in the history of the club, or more big medals, which makes it doubly strange that he can come on and... Look, he seems like the perfect guy to be coming on and playing that role, but...
I just wonder if it's a kind of Sigurdsson syndrome where for a team like Swansea, because he's kind of the main outlet through which the attacks go, he's more involved in the attacks, whereas at Spurs, he's got people like Son, like Lucas Moura, like Dele Alli behind him, who kind of hold on to the ball a bit more and, you know, like to play it out around the midfield before getting it to him, whereas at Swansea, it was a kind of one-way traffic to Llorente.
I hope Sigurdsson syndrome catches on. Ali says, how important is it for Spurs to remain in form until the end of the season if England are to be successful in Russia? Sure, you wrote a piece about this, Barney, about basically England should just pick the Spurs team. I think it was just after Harry Winks had played particularly well against Real Madrid.
Yeah, I mean, why not pick players in their club positions where they're developing a kind of natural understanding? If you look at all the successful, most of the successful teams from the last 20 years at tournaments, that's happened simply because those have happened to be the best players around often, but also because it simply makes sense. Obviously, that's not unlikely to happen in English football, partly because there's a kind of game you have to play with loyalty and with a kind of pecking order in the team and with keeping the clubs on side, and if you were to start dropping. So we all know there are players around the England team who probably don't deserve to be in it but keep getting picked. And that's not completely insane. You do have to show a certain sort of professional respect for these people and blah, 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 or everybody gets dissatisfied. But yeah, personally, I'd pick half the Spurs team and see how it goes.
Unfortunately, though, Bernie, you can't pick Christian Eriksen.
I was just about to say the same thing.
Or Dembele.
Or Son.
Or Alderweireld.
Yeah, you can't pick any of them. They're not English. Yes. But I think I was probably suggesting picking the English ones.
No, I know exactly what you mean, but I think, you know, say Eriksen in particular brings the best out of them in a way that the best is not necessarily brought out.
But this is a kind of... There is a tendency to say this, isn't there, about English teams? Like, this is a reverse snobbery. Without Eriksen, they won't possibly be able to play. And obviously, he's a really good player.
Well, that's not what I said.
That's why he's in that team. And he has improved in the Premier League massively, partly through playing with his Spurs teammates and being coached by a very good coach. But I think the basic understanding between those players in that team would still work.
The winner of that replay, Rochdale Spurs, will play the winners of the replay between Sheffield Wednesday and Swansea, a goalless draw on Carlos Carvajal's return to Hillsborough.
If any match should not be replayed, it is that one. I sat through it on Saturday afternoon and, oh, it was... dreadful.
Carvajal said, I believe if you'd asked us and the Sheffield Wednesday manager, we would have gone to penalties. It's a bit like the Police Academy films. First there's one and then there's too many. I quite liked the Police Academy. I think I only got bored at around Police Academy 6, but maybe that says more about...
What are we up to now?
I think I only got to 7.
What's the Fast and the Furious at? 8, isn't
eight.
It? I think 8.
I believe 8.
You've seen all of those?
No. Not for me.
I have not seen a single Fast and Furious.
Me neither.
Are they still Fast and Furious, even now, after 8 films?
That's Are they faster and furiouser?
Will they just get to a point where they can't be more furious and they just go into like a zen mode?
What is the source of their fury?
Sure. They're driving really fast.
We can ask the West Brom players.
It's a good idea. Gareth Southgate was at the game, the Swansea-Sheffield Wednesday game, to have a look at Alfie Mawson. You were talking about players who are being picked when there are potentially better players being picked. The only trouble was Mawson pulled up during the warm-up with a knee problem, and so Gareth Southgate didn't get to see him.
He locked his knee, didn't he? His knee was locked.
Oh, is it sounds, still locked?
I don't know. It sounds horrible, though, doesn't it? My thoughts are with him.
Yeah, I hope someone's managed to sort of unlock his knee. The draw, weirdly, was done on Saturday night. Some people got very upset that the FA Cup draw was done before all the games had been played. Did seem a bit strange. Are any of you very angry about this?
I wouldn't say I'm even remotely irritated at all in any way, but I kind of like a one-show FA Cup draw.
It's not a robust way of doing it, though, is it? You should wait till all the games are done, partly because we know football's going to be cynical business, and if you realise you're going to be away at, you know, Man City in the next round, you might change your team.
Hmm. The one show is a great way of the FA Cup draw happening. Do you want to describe, especially for our foreign listeners who probably, I mean, I really hope they don't go to the extent of turning on the one show.
Well, the one show was a sort of weeknight magazine show with a sofa, and they have guests on, so Giles Brandreth could do a video clip on clock towers in Shropshire, and then there might be a demonstration of falconry. And then...
Is that more interesting than Swansea Shuffle Wednesday?
Anything was more interesting than Swansea Shuffle Wednesday.
There'd always be a very famous person.
Then Judi Dench.
Yeah.
Or no, it's generally some former Hollywood A-lister who's not as big a draw as they used to be, who can't get on Graham Norton's show. Mm-hmm. They rock up. You know, it could be...
Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah. Mm. And then they have the FA Cup draw. And as the draw is made, they have a supporter from each team who walks out and... shakes hands with their opposite number and forms a line at the back of the studio. It's all very odd, but strangely compelling.
Moving on to Manchester United beating Huddersfield 2-0. Romelu Lukaku scored two great goals. The big story, though, was VAR disallowing a Juan Mata goal correctly, but the graphics people saw on the TV showed some squiggly lines. It's just such a joy. Tom says, as a school teacher, I have access to many rulers and I'm therefore able to draw straight lines. Does this make me overqualified to work for VAR? I mean, you couldn't write it. It was marvellous, Barry.
Yeah, and apparently they're not those squiggly lines with the nice little sort of curve around Juan Mata and then continuing on straight-ish is not the line on which they based their decision, but it's the line on which vast swaths of the viewing public think yeah. they based their decision.
Do you believe them? Oh, no, we had some other lines.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not wholeheartedly... I'm mellowing on my position on VAR. It's taken me a long time to come. I was emphatically against it. Then I thought, it might work with tweaks, and I still think it might work with tweaks, but... I'm very much enjoying the manner in which it isn't working whatsoever.
Or even
before those tweaks are made.
Even when it does work, it's incredibly entertaining in the amount of time it takes, the sort of pain and frustration of everybody just waiting around. Like the player, you know, something needs to happen in that time, doesn't it?
Yeah, I seem like the next step, if you're thinking about the commercialization of the league, is just to mic the referees up and, you know, listen to their decision-making process or something. But actually, VAR is, if you want to blame someone, it's probably the Dutch, because it was a Dutch former referee called Mike van der Roest who came up with the whole idea back in 2010. But even in the Netherlands, I think it was first week of February when they played the cup games that Roda and Willem II were playing. Roda had a goal disallowed because a player had handled the ball in the process. But they thought they should have just played advantage, something like that. And they're basically taking the Dutch FA to court now. So VAR has not been the kind of resounding success they intended it to be.
Imagine how boring that court case is. Just the mind boggles. I mean, I'm sort of anti-VAR person. The thing that... It's just amazing that we're talking about this offside decision now and some stupid TV bit. The idea that football is just a series of injustices and things to be angry about lies behind VAR. I mean, I was listening to Radio 4 this morning and they told this... Sorry, this is a really boring, long story.
Well, we've got time.
But just the idea that the people who favour VAR and think VAR is a good thing are on the side of science and light and enlightenment and flushing out the cobwebs is, in my opinion, completely wrong. If you support this, analysing every single refereeing decision for perceived injustices, you're actually giving in to an emotional impulse. The myth that football is governed by false refereeing decisions, that's the only reason anything happens. If you actually look at the data on how many bad game-affecting decisions there are, it's very few. And the decision on do we really want to utterly change the game for that, it's illogical. There's a story about on Radio 4 this morning about Donald Trump when he was having a debate with a leading scientist, really top scientist, about whether vaccinating children gives them autism. Now, this scientist had all the facts, has all that he knows. This is his field. He knows that it doesn't. The facts say no. The stats say no. He's going to thrash Trump. He knows everything. But Trump, you know, is Trump. So he tells a story about a little child being injected with the phrase was a horse tranquilizer syringe and then being ill. And how can you argue with that? And he absolutely trounces this expert who has all the facts, who knows that, you know, the data suggests. So the people, we have effectively elected Trump by giving in to the idea we need VAR. We've given in to the emotional idea that there are constant injustices, that football teams are being menaced by syringes the size, you know, that referees are ruining football with their very marginal, utterly debatable calls that in reality don't really affect what happens in football matches. What happens is whether you have more money and better players. And to obsess about the referee, to obsess about injustices, is to give in not to data and enlightenment, but to this emotional obsession with injustice.
Do you think that most right-thinking, sensible people are aware that there is no big conspiracy and that referees aren't part of the Illuminati conspiring against various teams, but it's the people, the weirdos and freaks who do think otherwise shout loudest on the internet and...
Well, and football managers. I mean, this is chickens coming home to roost. We're constantly blaming referees for everything. When you haven't prepared your team properly and you've lost and you blame the referee. Well, now we have a game which is obsessed with referees and which is being absolutely broken down into units of refereeing and nothing else.
But then VAR does go to some extent to kind of alleviate that blame on referees, because now they have like something.
How's that working
there
out this weekend?
No, but I mean, I kind of agree with the fact that it doesn't quite suit football, because if you look at the sports that have implemented it, like tennis and cricket, they have breaks as a kind of natural part of the game. You have these occasional stoppages in play, and that's not considered unnatural. But in football, obviously, you know, when the ball goes out of play, you don't stop for like a minute and a half. You just kind of carry on with it unless you're time wasting. But I do think it adds value in as much as... So I think, to my knowledge, in Germany and Italy, it is a bit more accepted now than it was at the start of the season. And at the weekend, there was a funny incident where Marek Hamsik scored a goal, went to celebrate, kicked over a corner flag, got yellow carded for breaking the corner flag, and then his goal was disallowed because of VAR.
Can that yellow card be rescinded? Because technically the celebration shouldn't have counted either.
Just kind of, it does open up more alleys.
Sorry,
for
I interrupted
debate,
the story there.
No, I mean, it's just, I think it has value, but, you know, it needs improvement in as much as it needs to be quicker. And I think there needs to be a threshold for, you know, this is a decision that should be referred, or this is a decision that... So the Juan Mata call, I thought, was marginal enough that it comes down to a human subjectively interpreting an image again, which is ideally what the referees are already doing on the pitch. And I think there should be a threshold in as much as, okay, let's do it for handballs, let's do it for red cards, let's do it for whatever. But if it's small enough that human error can be conceded either way, then, you know, just carry on with play.
Producer Jonathan has a point of law, which is in VAR.
See, this is the problem with VAR. This discussion is everything that's wrong with football.
Well, we haven't talked about the game at all.
Why aren't we talking about the excellent pass to Mata to score that goal? I mean, why are we talking about refereeing decisions which are so minor and marginal? It's so tedious.
Well, I'm quite entertained by the last 5 minutes of discussion.
Following on from what Jonathan said about the Harry Kane and Lovren thing.
Just to be clear, producer Jonathan has said, listen, it's all about glaring errors apart from offside, which is right or wrong according to the laws. You disagree, Barney?
Well, there are plenty of offside decisions which are a matter of opinion.
Well, I mean, because you think of Kane versus Liverpool and how Lovren played him on, but... yesterday when Borussia Dortmund and Mönchengladbach played, Mönchengladbach equalised via a similar goal where basically I think it was Vestergaard who got the ball in an offside position but came off a defender, and that was disallowed in VAR. So you still have that kind of subjectivity between two relatively similar situations.
Does anybody want to talk about the game at all?
Well, I think it was quite interesting afterwards. Jose Mourinho, who famously complains when other managers cry about injuries, spent a lot of time crying about injuries, and he's got quite a few of them coming up for Manchester United's game against Sevilla, which I think Barney's going to, and Romelu Lukaku, his record against big teams is not good. You know, he's sort of got a reputation as something as a flat track bully, which I suppose the statistics speak for themselves. You know, Manchester United, with the injuries they have, might struggle.
Are you looking forward to your trip, Don?
Yeah, very much so, yeah. I mean, I think they'll probably get past Sevilla. I'm looking forward to seeing them actually playing at that late stage of the Champions League with Mourinho as manager, because, you know, we know what he's like. He's a evil, winning, cynical genius in his own way. How will he approach these games? I mean, I think they're not a great team. They're not great to watch. There's all sorts of problems there, but I still wouldn't rule them out actually winning the competition.
Is that a croissant?
Yeah, sorry.
No, don't apologise. But just all butter or a chocolate croissant?
It's one of those quite bready ones. You know, it's just like a slightly sweet piece.
Slightly
of bread.
Brioche-y.
A little bit, yeah.
I want croissants to be on the other end, the crispy end of the spectrum.
Oh, that flaky and crispy.
Very flaky. Mm.
Yeah. No, I'm afraid not.
Okay. Oh, bad luck. We'll start part two talking about Barcelona, taxis and McDonald's. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. Before we talk about anything else, we're going to Dublin to do a live show. Barry, you're coming.
Yes.
Barney, you're coming.
Yeah.
And we're bringing a Jonathan Wilson. A great chance for
being subbed out.
Yeah, you're subbed out, Priya. A great chance, though, for us to do the gig, go to the pub and then steal a taxi on our way from McDonald's. Daniel Hewitt writes, ITV journalist, West Brom have stolen as many taxis under Alan Pardew as they've won Premier League games. So Barry, once we the important thing to say, we don't condone stealing of cars, and if anyone was driving under the influence of alcohol, we don't condone that either.
No.
Can we then find this story absolutely hilarious?
I think so, yes. It is quite amusing. The fact they stole a taxi, the people involved, you would expect better from those...
Gareth Barry!
Senior professionals with a combined age of, I think, well over 100. I was listening to Joey Barton on TalkSport this morning. He couldn't see anything wrong with it whatsoever, you know. And even Alan Brazil was tutting with disapproval. But no, Joey couldn't see what the harm was. But it's just baffling because they were in a cab. They were already in the cab with a driver whose sole function in his professional life is to take them from where they are to where they want to go. He was in place. And yet somehow they decided, he left the car, I think, if the stories are correct, to go and buy food they were not allowed by because of the state they were in. And while he was away, one of them had to move from the seat he was in, get out of the car, get into the driver's seat and drive off in a foreign city with which I presume they're not too familiar, driving on the wrong side of the road. Possibly under the influence of alcohol. We don't know that. And it just makes no sense.
They didn't even get their dinner.
Mm. It's funny, though. I remember when Alan Pardew was appointed, there was a lot of talk about how the players will start to enjoy themselves and how he's someone who makes the dressing room feel good and there's a sense of fun about it. There's a bit of you win game, you can have a good time, you know, that's fine. And presumably this is exactly what the owners had in mind. When they appointed exactly this kind of incident, which everyone has enjoyed so much. I agree. It's we should be careful saying steal. I mean, they borrowed, didn't they? They didn't steal a car. I mean, they borrowed it.
What's... You sure?
Well, stealing is
did they ask
intention
the driver
to
if they
permanently
could borrow it?
Deprive. I don't think they wanted to keep
the They car. Didn't break into it, did they? They were already in it. So you can't break into a car that you're already in. Classic English problem, though. You were saying, you know, the driver of not picking the right players in the right positions. They've got the driver in the right position. they've done away with that. Alan Pardew said, we've got to put in a performance against Southampton. He stripped Johnny Evans of the captaincy to make a statement, as he said. But if you know, once he's told us he's just doing it to make a statement, is he making a statement?
That's a statement in like font 10 size, like tiny bit on an A4 sheet. That's as much a statement it is, because if that was if that was like a youth team player or if that was anyone in the reserve squad, I don't think they'd be receiving the same treatment that Evans and Barry are currently, because it's just inconceivable to me that they've acted so kind of out of the discipline that he said they broke his curfew and he's still kind of fine with playing them. I mean, in a kind of general, anywhere else but in a football context, anyone doing that sort of thing on a work holiday or like a work trip would not be just brought back into the job immediately.
True, but in no other world do adults have curfews, do they? I mean, it's just such a strange thing to have. Yeah. I imagine if someone told me I had a curfew, you know me, Barry, I don't want to go out past 9 p.m. But if someone told me I had to be back in at 11, I'd want to be.
Well,
out
I think
later.
We've seen why they have a curfew. I mean, Alan Pardew, when talking about this, all he's referred to, and the players have also referred to, is breaking the curfew, as if being late back to the hotel was the big problem here.
But it's interesting what Priya says. I mean, I don't know much about other jobs. I mean, what if you like work in an office and do, you know, you do deals or whatever people do in offices, and you went on a work trip and you borrowed a taxi? Would you be fired or something?
You probably would, wouldn't you?
Would you? I don't know. What happens in jobs?
When you're
looking at when you're completely the wrong people, aren't you?
When you're in Seville, nick one and see what happens.
Yeah, just
when
as
you
a,
get back.
No, but this is not.
I reckon you'd be hauled up for some sort of disciplinary chat.
Would there be like public statements? And ashen-faced Kath Reiner says, "Well, he's broken the curfew." You know, I don't know.
No, but this is not even the most entertaining theft involving footballers in English footballers in Spain. Because I think it was in the 90s that there was an Everton winger called Peter Beagrie who went to was on a trip with the team. Obviously, I think it was maybe pre-season to Sociedad. I think he broke curfew again and got very drunk. Asked a motorcyclist for a ride, for a lift back to the hotel, stopped at the wrong hotel, and realised he went to talk to the guy who was at the door and didn't know who was at the wrong hotel. And then somehow got control of the motorbike and ran away with it. And
he drove it through the plate glass window.
Sorry.
Producer Jonathan says he required 50 stitches. Did Peter Beagrie.
He drove it through the windows of the hotel, didn't he? I mean, that was my understanding.
Yeah, and it wasn't his hotel.
It's like a scene from Lethal Weapon.
And then, I mean, the origin of that song about Niall Quinn's disco pants, I think that stemmed from a brutal fight he had with Steve McMahon on a Manchester City pre-season tour. And his clothes were soaked in blood, I think. So.
In the disco.
John Anarisa and
Craig Bellamy in the golf club.
Yeah,
that was at La Manga, was it, or somewhere?
I think it was Algarve. Not sure, but it was the same a tour that Liverpool did where Peter Crouch nearly killed Dirk Kuyt because they went go karting. Rafa Benitez took them go karting.
Peter Crouch in a go kart is a great image, anyway, isn't it?
He can't even fit in. But apparently his brakes weren't working. He was about to go into either Xabi Alonso or Dirk Kuyt.
And he chose Dirk Kuyt.
Alonso is more valuable. Let's go into Dirk Kuyt.
Well, that's slightly different, though, isn't it?
If you remember, they then beat Barcelona. There was a famous golfing celebration. Yeah. So, obviously, we're waiting for a taxi celebration, aren't we?
Mm. And presumably they didn't do it on Saturday because everyone was so amazed that Salomon Rondon scored with that fantastic volley, which was...
Great goal.
Yeah, I was sorry to actually talk about something that happened on the pitch.
Van Persie-esque connection with the ball.
They should have won that game, actually. They dominated Southampton totally in the second half. Rondon's goal... Well, there's three good goals, but Rondon's pick of them. But apparently Pardew has now been given two games to save his job. I think they're against Huddersfield at home and Watford away.
Who will they bring in if they get rid of Pardew?
Tony Pulis available?
No, he's
they've,
not.
They've
is
gone
he?
From Pulis's buses to stealing taxis now. Clearly the only way is to go back to buses.
Chelsea 4, Hull 0. I've written, is Willian underrated? Barney.
Well, I don't think he's underrated in Brazil. Do you mean he should play more often?
Well, I just don't... He's not part, in my mind, of the best footballers in the Premier League conversation. And whether he should be, is he that good? He's scored or assisted in a combined 20 goals in competition for Chelsea. It's only Hazard's done more.
Yeah, he's a really good player. And he sort of puts a shift in and so on. I'm not... I don't really understand why Antonio Conte, obviously he obviously understands what he's doing much better than I do, but I'm not quite clear as to why he shifted the system from last year, which, you know, Willian and Pedro were a big part. I know he's gone back to that at times, but I think a Chelsea team with Willian in is always better.
Mm. And Giroud looks like a very good purchase, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's got that connection with Hazard now, and Hazard kind of likes playing with these big strikers. Even when Diego Costa was available at certain points, he always liked playing with someone like Didier Drogba, who at that point, at the age of, 36, 37, all he could do was just hold off a defender and flick it onto Hazard. I mean, Giroud's assist for Hazard's first goal the other day in the Premier League, was that against Huddersfield?
No, it was against... Oh, God, I was there. It was against... Oh, my God. He got kicked really hard.
It was against West Brom.
Yes, Johnny Evans kicked him. That's right.
And Giroud basically took just as much a touch of the ball as could be classified as a touch. It wasn't even a pass to Hazard. And basically... But he did drag away most defenders away from Hazard and created that space for him. And he thrives in that kind of big man, little man partnership. And I think because Alvaro Morata is quite adept with his feet beyond just that, there is a sort of, you know, kind of style... not to say contradiction, but he's very different to play with than what Hazard is used to with strikers. I actually think if Giroud starts against Barcelona, probably that's the best front line that I think Chelsea can go with is Hazard, Giroud and Pedro, going back to the kind of 3-4-3 as opposed to the two-man strike partnership that they had at the start of the season.
I think we should add the caveat that they were playing Hull, who have won 8 games in all competitions this season, were ravaged by injuries and cup-tied players who had David Myler playing out of position at full-back and absolutely tormented. And I would be careful of reading too much into this Chelsea win. Although, having said that, I was very impressed with Ethan Ampadu, who so composed for such a young kid. And I think, you know, possible future Chelsea captain.
Really? And great hair, isn't it? I sort of wondered if it makes you run a bit slower. Like, how heavy is it?
I don't know. You're looking at me as though I'm always piping up about these kind of hair weight stats.
I don't wonder. I mean, obviously, you've never had a big head of dreadlocks.
Given Willie Caballero's record with penalties, if it ever comes to that point that Chelsea go to penalties in Champions League or something, whether Conte will consider doing like a Louis van Gaal
Tim
goalkeeper
Krul
substitution for the shootout.
Oh, I'm a big fan of those. On Chelsea-Barcelona Champions League affairs, the referee of the 2009 semi-final second leg, Tom Henning of Rebo, has admitted he made decisions and they were not the best during that game. He detailed how he had to change the hotel he was staying in that night because of the hostility him and his team faced after the match. It was a strange... I mean, remember that? Yeah. Chelsea should have had about 28 penalties.
Was that the Ballack
game?
Yeah, that was strange, wasn't it?
It's kind of odd that this coincides in this week when we're really talking about referees. I'm sorry, Barney. because basically every Chelsea-Barcelona fixture since 2004 has always been marred by some kind of refereeing conspiracy, and I don't think it's a coincidence that Jose Mourinho was at the centre of most of that, but it's odd. You think of Anders Frisk and then of Rabiot, obviously, and then I remember even the Turkish referee who refereed the second leg in 2012 is also the referee for Tuesday's game, I think, and he sent off, I think it was John Terry, for a knee in Alexis Sanchez's back.
Yeah, that's right.
They play...
But don't you think these refereeing... It's more to do with the fact that they always try and kick Lionel Messi. I mean, you know, it's because of the tactics of the team rather than the referee's an idiot or there's a conspiracy.
I actually think it's going to be a very interesting game because all the kind of games until 2012 were always with that core that Jose Mourinho had built and had that kind of siege mentality going about them. This Chelsea side is very different to that. They don't have that kind of core of leaders, you know, the Lampard and the Drogba and Terry. And there is a sort of deficiency there. And yeah, it's kind of odd that Chelsea have actually bought two of the players from the Barcelona match they scored from that year, which is in Fabregas and Pedro. And yeah, I think it's going to be a very interesting game to see just how Chelsea and Barcelona have changed in the years since that game.
Chelsea will play Leicester in the quarterfinal of the FA Cup. Leicester beat Sheffield United 1-0. Riyad Mahrez played quite well, seems to have sort of got over his little strop. And the other game that we haven't covered yet, Brighton 3, Coventry 1. Good for Chris Hughton that Lacadia and Ajoa both scored. Do you want to tell us more about Lacadia? Don't have to.
Well, yeah, he was kind of part of the batch at PSV along with Jorginho, Wijnaldum, and well, actually, Wijnaldum's a bit older and he was bought from Feyenoord, but Memphis Depay. And he kind of suffered for a few years because he was shunted out to the left and the right, and he always just wanted to play up front. Couldn't play on the left when Memphis Depay was there, obviously, and then never really worked as much on the right. And it was only the start of this season that he kind of finally got his chance as Luke de Jong was dropped and Lacadia was the main man up front, got what he wanted. And he did perform pretty well at the start of the season. The first half of the season was pretty impressive. But this is a kind of signing that can go both ways, as do most signings from the Eredivisie these days, I guess. There's a kind of resignation in that fact. He's got a very good shot. I should probably mention that. To his credit, he's got a very good shot on him. And I think Brighton is probably a team that suits him as well, because he's never played with a creator like Pascal Gross behind him, kind of working very closely in that central axis. And yeah, I think it's a kind of... I know he's a club record signing, but given that fee, I think he won't be as, you know, pressurised to perform. I don't think he'll carry as much a burden as perhaps Memphis Depay did.
Spice Boy says, I met Ajoa in the big Tesco in Hove on Friday afternoon. I wasn't surprised he scored in the cup because he looked like he was cooking a very healthy meal the day before the game. I was surprised what an absolute unit he was. Have any of the podders ever been shocked by a footballer's size in real life?
I was shocked by how small Roy Keane was.
Are you saying you could have him?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying I actually sort of walked past him in a corridor backstage at the Crucible Theatre one time while during the snooker final, and I was slightly taken aback by the fact that up close and personal he's considerably smaller than I am. I didn't think he would be.
Barry makes a very interesting point. Footballers are smaller than you think. Just because they have no excess, unlike most of us, they have no excess. If you were to stand next to an average, I don't know, Aaron Ramsey, you'd be surprised at how lean and small they are, because they're all muscle. Not they're not strong, but even quite big footballers are actually quite small.
And we all know that N'Golo Kanté is tiny, but honestly, he is. I mean, I'd say he's half my height. It literally is absolutely minuscule. It's unbelievable. I look at him and you sort of think he can't be good at football because he's so tiny. Football League news: Wolves were held by Preston at Deepdale. Preston were one up when they had John Welsh sent off. Wolves equalised 2 minutes later, couldn't get the 3 points though. Sean Morrison scored the only goal as Cardiff climbed to second with a 1-0 win over Middlesbrough. Aston Villa's amazing winning run ended with a 2-0 defeat at Fulham. Ryan Sessegnon with another goal. Villa are still third. Bristol City are still in the playoff places despite giving up a 2-0 lead to Leeds at Elland Road. That game finished 2-2. In the big East Anglian derby, I watched this.
So did I.
On an exercise bike.
I wasn't on it. I was on a bar stool.
Literally.
Tells you all you need to know about the difference between the two of us, I suppose.
Nothing happened until the last 2 minutes. James Maddison was quite good for Norwich, I thought, but nothing happened. Luke Chambers
headed... He was a standout player on the field.
Luke Chambers headed Ipswich in front in the 89th minute. A brilliant celebration from Mick McCarthy. Ipswich hadn't won the derby for 9 years. It's the fifth minute of injury time. Would you like to hear the BBC Radio Suffolk commentary?
Oh yeah.
The area, Bielkowski goes after it, Hanley gets there first, Bielkowski's out of his area, Hanley knocks it into the centre, a chance! Oh, Norwich have equalised! How awful! Oh no! When are Ipswich Town ever going to beat them? It's closer! Gunners run the length of the field! Oh, this is heartbreaking
centre. It's Norwich City 1, Ipswich Town 1.
Absolutely brilliant pain. A meaningless mid-table championship game, aside from the fact that they're big rivals. Well,
producer Mel was very, very annoyed at Mick McCarthy's celebration of the Ipswich goal. I fail to see what the fuss
was. Do you think they would have held on and won if he'd instead tapped his head?
Yes.
And done that kind of think about it.
Nil, next five, nil, nothing silly. Adams writes, how many times have you watched that Mick McCarthy gif? I think I'm up to three figures and I still can't stop smiling despite having no allegiance to Ipswich or Mick.
I love Mick.
Oh, I think everybody loves Mick apart from Ipswich fans. And he goes on big, long cycle rides. I interviewed him once, and all we talked about was how he puts full lycra on and cycles around Suffolk on every morning, which is a nice image. Both of those sides, Norwich and Ipswich, are boringly mid-table. Midweek, they take on the top two. Norwich go to Wolves. Ipswich host Cardiff. There's a full programme. In League One, leader Shrewsbury lost 1-0 at home to fourth-place Rotherham, who've now won 6 on the trot and unbeaten in 13. Second-place Wigan didn't play because they're playing Manchester City tonight in the FA Cup. Blackburn are third. They won 2-1 at Portsmouth. Rochdale at the bottom have at least 4 games in hand on their rivals. In League Two, Luton didn't play. They're still top. Second place Wickham won 2-0 at Cheltenham. Adebayo Akinfenwa scored one and set up another. They're level on points with Accrington Stanley in third. And managerless Cambridge United have now won 2-2. It's exciting. A 3-1 crushing of Grimsby. Before we forget, last Thursday, Arsenal went to Östersund. We predicted they might have a bit of trouble, Barry. You did.
I did, and I was wrong.
Would you like to apologise to anyone?
No.
Okay. Celtic beat Zenit 1-0, which is well done to them. In Fitbar, a question from David McAnally says, is Josh Windass better than his dad? Who else has eclipsed their dad's professional playing career? I don't... he's a good player, but I don't think he is.
Both players, I think. But it depends on what you kind of deem professional, how far you want to go back. But both Ruud Gullit and Frank Rijkaard's fathers were both professional players in Suriname before they came to the Netherlands. But I mean, you can think of Arnor and Ada Good Johnson,
Paolo Maldini, yeah. Frank Lampard,
Michael Owen's dad played occasionally. I mean, see, all footballers whose dads didn't play any sort of professional sport,
Thiago,
I suppose.
Rafinha and Mazinho?
Mazinho. It's quite hard if you're... There's an interesting structural point. If your father is a very successful football player, it's going to be very hard to eclipse them, if only because football, so much of football is about desperation and wildness and hunger, isn't it? I mean, to become really, really, really good, most players emerge through some sort of prism of hardship. Mm. And if your father is a well-known footballer, you're unlikely to, perhaps go down that route.
I mean, Josh Windass did get a hat-trick. Back to that original question, I'm not sure he is better than his dad yet.
Dean Windass, a really good player.
Yeah. And scored that amazing goal for
Man City. And I'd argue Dean Windass has played at a much higher level than his son for quite a long time. I'll probably annoy lots of Scottish people by saying that, but... And he's got, quite the impressive... Although he did spend quite a while at Aberdeen, didn't he? Mm. But... yeah, I think it's too early to say whether Josh is better than him.
Josh still has the potential, doesn't he? Before we end part two, you will have seen the news reports about Barry Bunnell, the former football coach, convicted last week on 50 counts of abuse of young boys. He's going to be sentenced at some point today. He probably will have been sentenced by the time you listen to it. A horrific abuse of power against young boys who dreamt of playing professional football. There isn't a whole lot of substance that we can add here, rather than just pointing you in the direction of our chief football reporter, Daniel Taylor's tireless work in uncovering the details of the story and interviewing the incredibly brave victims who have waived their right to anonymity. Some of it is hard to read. Doesn't mean you shouldn't read it. We'll put links to the story on the Football Weekly page and we'll be back in a tick. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain. Sid Lowe is there. How are you doing, Sid?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great, thank you. Before we get on to any of the football, West Brom Taxigate in Barcelona, was there any mention of this in Spain?
Yeah, of course there was. Yeah, there was a sense of this is here go English footballers again. A friend of mine pointed out something quite important in all this, which is that beyond the behaviour of the players, beyond the behaviour of the coach and so on, who was the person at West Brom who decided that for warm winter training, you go to Barcelona in February? because it's not warm in Barcelona in February, and it certainly hasn't been warm recently. But anyway, that's by the by. So yeah, this has been picked up, and it's been picked up as a kind of a sense of, you know, this is kind of what English players do, isn't it?
Speaking of Barcelona, since that's where they were, they're 7 points clear at the top after what looks on paper like a regulation 2-0 win at Eibar, but it wasn't really like that. Is that fair?
No, and it wasn't likely to be in a way, by which I mean, you know, Eibar are really genuinely a very good side. I think I'm right in saying that it was 11 games unbeaten before this weekend. They made life very difficult for Barcelona. Busquets afterwards described them as having a peculiar style, which they do for a small club, in that they press very, very high, they're very attacking, they're aggressive, they get the ball wide, they put a lot of crosses in. But of course, what that does when you press very high against Barcelona is, even if it makes it difficult for them to bring it out the back, it does tend to mean with one pass they get a man beyond you, and that's what happened with the goal as Suarez scored at the opener, and then they got the second very late on. And the other reason why I think it's logical that it was going to be quite difficult, beyond the fact that Eibar are a good side, is that Barcelona have played, I actually worked this out yesterday and I forgot what the figure is, I think I'm right in saying 13 times since January the 4th, because obviously the Copa del Rey is squeezed, it's completely compressed into January in the first week of February, so it's been games every 3 days. And I genuinely think that's quite significant from Chelsea's point of view. And Busquets afterwards admitted that he would have quite liked them to have been able to play on Friday rather than on Saturday, because of course Chelsea had played on Friday. And he said, I don't know why that is. I suppose maybe it's something to do with the TV rights. Well, that's exactly what it is.
So do you think Chelsea have a good chance against Barcelona, or what's their way of winning this game?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say what's their way of winning, because obviously what we do, and maybe this is partly laziness on our part, but what you tend to do when you think about, right, how do you beat a team? You go and find the games in which that team's been beaten. Now, of course, that's quite difficult in Barcelona's case this year, because they've only been beaten once by Espanyol, who played played a curious system, because it was two different halves. So they were relatively tight and compact and defensive in the first half, played with two lines of four very close to each other, quite narrow as well, effectively saying, you know, Barcelona can have the wings, that bit of the pitch doesn't matter so much. But then in the second half changed. I think they took a midfielder off and put Baptistão on the pitch, so they then went for Barcelona a bit and got the goal in a really tough and aggressive game, but one that ultimately didn't matter because it was a two-legged cup game. So that, again, kind of tempers this sense of, is this really a template for everybody else? The other thing is, if you look across the season, teams have caused Barcelona in two different ways. One has been the kind of traditional defensive, narrow, tight, don't give them space and not quite park the bus, but you know, sort of wait for them. And yet the teams that have made them look most uncomfortable have actually been the ones that have gone right up the pitch and pressed them, like Eibar did this weekend, and played very high intensity and not allowed them the way out. The problem with that, of course, is that if Barcelona get out once, they'll probably score.
While we're on the Champions League, Sevilla, Manchester United, Sevilla are fifth. Barney's going and would like you to give him a preview that he can take notes on.
If you could just talk for about 5 minutes, Sid, with some sacred
points. Yeah, and you'll take all day. I'll actually be there with you, Barney, so I can probably talk you through this while we're actually...
Can you bring the sweets again, please?
Yeah, that's true. I do need to bring a really, really big bag of sweets and maybe one of the hams from the garage.
Oh, yeah, hams from the garage, yeah.
Yeah, although I don't know if they'll let me on the train with a pig's leg over my shoulder. I can give it a go. Sevilla are a weird team in a way, because they defy the analysis in the sense that even earlier in the season, before they changed manager, when they were with Berizzo, they're a team that didn't have a kind of very clear identity. Theoretically, he's a coach that does very high intensity, pressing players all across the pitch, almost going man to man. But they kind of didn't really properly install that, and there was a sort of a lack of character about them. Vincent Montella's taken over, and of course it's quite early to properly see what it is that he's doing, but there's two or three players who've really, really improved under him. I mean, Sadabi, who's been pretty good all season, I think, but in particular Mudo Vazquez, who's this kind of curiously subtle kind of player who can often feel like he's not in the game at all, but then does very decisive things just off the forward. And bit by bit, they're starting to find their feet. I mean, I don't know if this is a horrible cliche, maybe it is, but there's a bit of me that thinks actually one of the most significant things about Sevilla is the stadium. I mean, genuinely, as Spanish stadiums go, there's a real sense of communion between kind of stands and the pitch. There's a sense of that kind of driving the team on. And even in their bad moments, they've had that ability to kind of produce kind of 20 minutes of real momentum and really kind of go for teams, really go for the throat, be very, very direct, not in the sense of long ball, but everybody bombing forward. And I suppose the best example of that was maybe the 3-3 against Liverpool, which you sort of got Sevilla in a nutshell, even as I say, they've changed manager now, where they're dreadful at the back, but when they really go for you, they do create chances.
Back to La Liga. Four wins on the trot for Atletico now, and a fun win for Real Madrid.
Yeah, Real Madrid. I mean, you know, there are many things that you can tell people who are kind of interested in Spanish football, things you must do, but one of them is always watch Betis. Betis have their games have had more goals in them than anyone else this season, except I think Real Sociedad. They were beaten 5-3 by Real Madrid last night, but you know, they were brilliant, and then Real Madrid were brilliant for about 20 minutes and just kind of completely blew them away. But then Betis came back into it, 4-3 with, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes to go, and then Madrid get the fifth at the end. I think I'm right in saying that Betis have now had something like 4-2-2s, I think 3-3-2s, 2-5-3s, 4-4, I believe, against Real Sociedad. They've been beaten 5-0 twice. So if you're going to watch a game, watch Betis every time.
Sid, thank you for your time as always.
My pleasure.
Have fun in Seville with Barney. Sid Lowe out in Spain. From there to Barry's Piazza.
Once again, it's as you were at the top of the Serie A table. Napoli had a 1-0 win over Spal. And Juventus followed suit with a 1-0 win over Torino in their derby. I think Juventus were slightly concerned going into this game because Torino had scored 8 and conceded none in their previous 3 games at home. But Juve were able to get the better of them. Alex Scandro scored for Juve after 33 minutes. That was enough to get the 3 points. It's being reported in the Italian press that Milan's owner, Yong Hong Lee, is bankrupt and that his assets will, and this sounds weird, be auctioned off on the Chinese equivalent of eBay. So I'm not sure what this means for Milan.
AC
but if,
Milan, that great traditional club with so many European Cups.
Yes, so I'm not sure when the auction ends or how long you have to put in your bid for Milan if they're part of the assets that are available on eBay. But
I've never bought anything on eBay.
Yeah, I bought a camera once and I ended up having to pay a load of import duty on it. So it was just a waste of time and money. But I digress. There have been questions about the state of this guy's finances before he took out huge loans to buy Milan from Silvio Berlusconi for €740 million. And he apparently now can't pay back those loans. Better news for Milan on the field. They beat Sampdoria 1-0. Gennaro Gattuso has urged his young striker, Patrick Cutrone, to get a beautiful girlfriend to relax and make love with, because he's worried that the pressure of playing for Milan regularly at such a young age will get to him, so he feels he should make the most of his downtime. So who could argue with that? The wife of Juve midfielder Claudio Marchisio was hit out at Max Allegri, manager of the team. Even with Blaise Matuidi and Sami Khedira injured, Marchisio still can't get in the team. They beat Torino 1-0, as I said, and his wife Roberta quoted the writer Gianni Herrera on social media in what was interpreted as a dig at Allegri. Tolerance reaches the line of reciprocal respect, but once it is past that, it is transformed, she wrote.
So, harsh words.
Oh, strongly spoken.
Does that complete a hat trick of footballers' wives speaking out for their husbands but
after the PSG
issues? Yeah,
the PSG
after
Instagram
Di Maria
time.
And Thiago Silva.
But the future Mrs. Rushton, does she ever stick up for you when you're getting abuse on?
No, she just joins in.
Other results at the bottom: Benevento had a good 3-2 win over Crotone. I don't know the details, but I believe you do because you alluded to them at the start.
I just saw the winner. And it's just because they've obviously lost so many games and they scored late on to win 3-2. It was an 89th minute. It was a bit of a scramble, but just the sheer joy and excitement and sort of surprise on every single part of the Benevento, the team, the coaching staff, the fans.
Bakary Sanya came on.
Did he really?
Yeah, at halftime.
There you go. But, you know, it's just I think there's something joyous in supporting a team that are doing so badly because loving sport is about expectation. If you have no expectation and you win, just the joy it brings you is much more than if you expect to win. So I'd rather be a Benevento fan than a Manchester City fan currently.
Well, they're 11 points from safety. Bottom three is Spal, Verona and Benevento. Spal, third from bottom, are 4 points behind Crotone.
All right. And in the Champions League, Roma travel to Kharkiv, Shakhtar Donetsk's current home, for their first leg on Wednesday. Is that the end of your piazza?
Yes, except I've been also been informed that Gonzalo Higuain has a sprained ankle, which I believe is a matter of grave concern for Burnley.
Yeah, Bunny, would you like to come into the piazza?
Well, let me just get through. So many ice creams on the table. Sorry, do you mind if I just push? Yeah, I mean, it's interesting with the second leg against Spurs coming up, particularly for me, as I wrote an article slamming him after his hit-and-miss performance. Naturally, he'll then come back and score a hat-trick, and people on social media will taunt me, but this won't happen if he's injured. But I think he's going to be okay, as far as that. Is that your understanding?
I have not diagnosed his poorly ankle or heard a prognosis.
So. Right. But I mean, just to be clear, he played very well against Tottenham as well. So
Just to go back to the...
Are you in the piazza as well?
I kind of sneaked in a while ago. But just to kind of... Because we were talking about VAR. I'm sorry, Barney.
Oh, no.
But Milan actually executed a really, really good free kick routine. They played it just kind of... It was on the left side. They played it straight down to someone who was making a run down the same flank, who crossed it in, and Bonucci scored. But it was ruled out by VAR because it was offside.
I mean, there is a sign that says no VAR in the piazza. It's like no ball games. We'll forgive you just this once. From Barry's Piazza to Lukas Podolski's kebab shop in Cologne, from which Archie Rintutt reports on the Bundesliga.
Right, so let's start in the relegation battle with Hamburg, the only team famously to have been present for every Bundesliga season, marked with a clock celebrating that fact at their stadium. But before their home game against Leverkusen on Saturday, a banner from the home ultras read, in the direction of the players it's assumed, "Before the clock comes down, we'll chase you through the city." A bit threatening, you might say, much like the club's predicament on the pitch because they lost 2-1, and some fans tried to actually get on the pitch at full time. So they're in 17th, an automatic relegation spot, and, as former goalkeeper Frank Rost put it, "I always compare it with the three doors you had on Takeshi's castle. You know behind one door is someone who's going to punch you in the face. Hamburg run through the same door every year." And that same door is usually the relegation playoff, but they're 6 points off current occupants Mainz, who won away for the first time in a year, won 2-0 at Hertha on Friday night. Then on Saturday, you had Wolfsburg-Bayern. They won despite conceding first for the third time in their last five games. Typically, it came from Robert Lewandowski, league's top scorer, in the last minute as well. But he, like a number of Bayern stars, started on the bench, with Besiktas coming up in the Champions League on Tuesday. Now, convincing it wasn't, but when you win 15 of your last 16 Bundesliga games, it doesn't really matter. This isn't the best Bayern side of recent years, I would say, but I struggle to see Besiktas troubling them too much on Tuesday. The only other two teams in European action this week from a German point of view are in the Europa League. Borussia Dortmund, who beat Gladbach 1-0 on Sunday. Delicious effort from Marco Reus if you get the chance to see it. They're 3-2 up on Atalanta ahead of the return leg in Italy, which is where Leipzig went to and won last Thursday. They beat Serie A leaders Napoli 3-1, even if they were playing against a weakened side and no one really turned up, which has been highlighted here in Germany. Leipzig are involved in the first Monday night game of the season against Frankfurt. Top six game, that. Big protests planned by the home supporters, reflecting the nationwide disgust amongst the hardcore support anyway for the Bundesliga being played on Monday night. Upset with the continued commercialisation, that is. And these protests are set to include the home fans being rumoured to have bought 5,000 Vuvuzelas to blow whenever Leipzig get the ball.
Thank you, Archie. To my boulangerie, Strasbourg took an early lead at PSG, only held it for 4 minutes, and were 3-1 down after 22 minutes. They pulled it back to 3-2, two late goals for Edison Cavani, gave the leaders a 5-2 win. PSG are 12 points clear of Monaco, who won 4-0 at home to Dijon. Marseille are third, they beat Bordeaux 1-0. Priya, give us an Eredivisie roundup from your waffle shop.
My waffle shop. I did bring waffles in today.
You did, yeah.
I mean, refereeing decisions again. Let's not go into that. By which I mean, let's go into that. PSV drew 2-2 with Heerenveen. They're still top of the league, but star winger Mexican Irving Lozano was sent off for what was allegedly an elbow into the face of an opponent. Or some people suggest it was a fairly innocuous arm movement that wingers do to, like, just, you know, shield the ball. But the referee thought there was some malice in there, so he was off. And PSV went on to concede two. Ajax cut the gap to five at the top of the league. But, I mean, the kind of elbow in the face by an attacker narrative continued there, because Klaas-Jan Huntelaar and Bram van Polen were kind of going at each other for a bit. Van Polen tugged at Huntelaar's shirt. He seemed to retort by burying his elbow into Van Polen's face. But to be fair, Van Polen came out after the game and said, oh, it's just something, you know, things that happen in football. There didn't seem to be any kind of malice in it. And Huntelaar went on to score the winner by nutmegging Peck Zwolle keeper Diederik Boer, who interestingly used to play for Ajax and only has 9 fingers.
which one is missing?
I think it's his little one on one of the hands. I'm not entirely sure. Okay. But there is a picture of him somewhere just holding up 9 fingers. There's a 5-point lead at the top for PSV. And AZ, who won 3-1 versus NAC Breda, are 7 points behind in third. And if you're tuning into the World Cup in the summer, I'd suggest keeping an eye out for AZ winger Alireza Yahanbakhsh, who'll be turning up for Iran. He's very good.
Producer Jonathan just showed me a picture. It's the little finger on his right hand. There it is, that is missing.
Well, it's quite amazing, isn't it? Given a goalkeeper's entire trade is his fingers, and he's missing 10%.
He's been going for ages as well. It's quite amazing. He's kind of made a very long career out of that, despite...
Has there ever been an occasion where he's dived from full length and the ball has just gone through that gap?
Looking at the glove, it doesn't seem that he has a custom... It's got the 4 fingers and a thumb. It's got the full requisite. He's holding the glove in the other hand. Well, producer Jonathan has done some research. Apparently, he was 12... he had all his fingers and he climbed on the roof to collect a tennis ball. And it was wet and slippery and he slipped and he tried to grab hold of a skylight and then he fell from the roof. And on landing on the floor, he realised he had hold of the tennis ball but was one finger light. That's how it happened. In violence news in Brazil, has anyone seen the Bahia State Championship match between Vitória and Bahia? Abandoned after 10 red cards and 8 yellows. Only 6 bookings in the first half. Bahia awarded a penalty in the 50th minute. Chaos ensued when Vinicius celebrated by scoring and dancing, sort of a bit of a grinding thrust in front of the home supporters. Both sets of players piled in. Punches were thrown. After a delay of 16 minutes to restore order, the referee sent off 8 players. 3 red cards were shown to Vitória players, 5 to Bahia players, with Vinicius and 3 substitutes among those dismissed. The game continued. Vitória then had 2 further players dismissed, 11 minutes from time. So the game had to be abandoned because they didn't have enough players on the pitch. Bahia likely to be awarded a 3-0 victory. On their Twitter, Bahia accused Vitória of deliberately having the last 2 men sent off. But certainly a game you'd talk about. Questions and feedback corner. I'll just do one. And this is Henry Moffat, who has the misfortune of listening to the pod while walking past me as I walk to a cafe every Tuesday morning.
You go to the same cafe every Tuesday morning?
Yeah. And I go and get a coffee with the future Mrs. Rushton. And this chap took his headphones off and said, look, this is like the 5th time I've walked past you. And he has to see me and listen, which seems like overkill. Anyway, he wanted to ask this question. His friends they need to know about a Christian Vieri goal he either did or didn't score. It's a long-running debate, unsolvable by Google. Many of his friends have it in mind that Vieri scored a header for Inter from outside the box, which is considered to be the header, he says, in capital letters. The internet disagrees. We need an expert to help save our sanity. I mean, I doubt any of us know about Christian Vieri scoring this amazing header, but it's one that we can put out there to the rest of the world. And I did wonder what you...
I know someone who'd know.
We don't talk about
it. Who's that? Anyway, what would you consider the header, though? Because I would...
Luis Suarez. I can't remember who it was against, but outside the box for Liverpool.
I would say Ruud Gullit, Euro 88.
Oh, yeah, what a header that was.
I mean, he headed
That's the goal that everyone forgets about, because all they remember is Van Basten's goal.
Of course, but the power in that header is
that
unbelievable.
That Ruud Gullit goal, do you remember there was an advert for... like women's sanitary products, which basically riffed on that goal. The one where there's this sort of roller skating along.
Oh, body form.
Body form. Yeah. The body form advert.
The roller skating.
There was a goal scored in that advert by a dreadlock woman in a... which is exactly the same as Ruud Gullit's goal. I mean, she's even got dreadlocks. The cross comes from the same side. The header's the same. So obviously body form didn't forget about it.
Yeah.
Didn't Fabregas score that sort of wriggly worm header against Chile in the opening game of the last World Cup, was it?
Was that the header? I mean, you'd add Keith Houchin to the mix and you'd add Van Persie's header in the World Cup.
Ronaldo scored some good headers.
That is
There was
true.
A very good one
Sergio
against Rome,
as well.
Roma.
He's got a few in his locker.
Yes. Yeah.
Didn't Ronaldo score a header in the 2008 Champions League final?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah,
header.
That was good as well.
Mm. The header. Anyway, below the line, please, if you can help Henry Moffat. And that'll do for today. Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Barney.
Thank you.
Thank you, Priya.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.